Hello and welcome to RN, or you might be listening online at abc.net.au. I'm Paul Barclay. Tonight, Big Ideas really does live up to its name. How do we become a smarter Australia by 2030? How do we build a nation that fosters innovation and research? To answer these questions, we're off to the recent VESCI Symposium in Melbourne. VESCI was launched in 2004 and is a program aimed at bringing leading scientists and researchers back to Victoria. As was made very clear at the symposium, to create a culture of innovation, all players, including business, government, researchers and investors, need to be heard and give their different perspectives. So in a moment, you'll hear from three big thinkers who tackle key areas critical to Australia's future: healthy ageing, energy and sustainable foods. RN's Jonathan Green, host of Sunday Extra, is your moderator. And we'll start off with Professor Alan Trounson, president of the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine. During his career, Alan Trounson led a team to discover human embryonic stem cells. He created the first Australian stem cell centre and established the Monash Immunology and Stem Cell Laboratories. Here is Alan Trounson on healthy ageing.
Well, what about healthy ageing? Australian science and medicine is undoubtedly first rate. And just to remind you, there are plenty of scientists with a great record in international science and in the medical community. Their Nobel laureates feature regularly, from Brian Schmidt in physics in 2011 to a raft of laureates in physiology and medicine, including Elizabeth Blackburn in 2009 for physiology and medicine. For the chromosome protection by telomeres and the enzyme telomerase that extends the multiplication of cells, Barry Marshall and Robert Warren in 2005 for the discovery of the role of Helicobacter pylori in gastric ulcer disease, Peter Doherty in 1996 for cell-mediated immune defence, Bernard Katz in 1970 for humoral transmitters in nerve terminals, John Eccles in 1963 for ionic mechanisms of nerve cell membranes, McFarlane Burnett in 1960 for acquired immune tolerance, and Howard Florey in 1945 for penicillin. There are many other great medical discoveries that have arisen recently from Australian laboratories, including Ian Fraser's HPV vaccine for preventing cervical cancer, Don Medcar's colony-stimulating factors that have impacted medicine very broadly, Carl Wood's work on human IVF, among many others. One might have cause to be optimistic about the next 20 years, maybe even expect Australia to have a Minister of Science driving high-tech developments and a strong biotechnology industry employing scientists and medical graduates maturing in universities and research centres. This might rival the quantum benefits of the mining boom and particular sectors of the food industry that appear to rise and fall pretty regularly. However, it doesn't take much searching to demonstrate the disconnect between science discoveries and community utilisation of the potential discoveries. What is hampering our smartness in converting high-quality science discoveries to community benefit? Is Australian science research sustainable without the ability to expand beyond the publicly funded institutional base of universities, medical centres and CSIRO? Where's our biotech industry? Who spans the so-called valley of death? There are distinct scarcities of industry connected with the Australian medical research community and a lack of venture investment in the biosciences. However, a company such as Mesoblast can arise in the Australian environment to be the world leader in stem cell medicine with a market cap of more than $10.4 billion. And Silvio's a smart guy, but he's a lonesome guy out there in an area where we ought to have an incredible growth. In California, I developed academic research teams partnered with companies or utilising commercial consulting together with independent and in-house guidance to successfully navigate the translational pathway to clinical trials. Beginning in 2010, from pure discovery base, Our so-called disease teams are now entering registered clinical trials. Expect 10 by the end of 2014. They're now connected to industry and expected to fare extremely well. Areas such as the destruction of malignant cancer cells, cure of genetic disease such as beta thalassemia and sickle cell disease, cure of HIV/AIDS, cure of blindness, particularly macular degeneration and retinitis pigmentosa, a cure juvenile type 1 diabetes, and treatment for heart muscle damage from myocardial infarct, heart attack, spinal cord injury, and the deadly motor neuron diseases. Well, what about a big idea for 2030? And I'm going to give you one in immunology and stem cells defeating cancer. In 2030, we might expect the research has delivered us a way to defeat cancer by engineering the T-cell receptor, TCR it's called, to recognise cancer-specific antigens. These are the proteins that are specifically expressed by cancer cells. This chimeric antigen receptor, or CAR, C-A-R, CAR technology, could be introduced into patients' T-cells. The T-cells are the scavenging killer thymic instructor cells that aggressively target foreign infection or abnormal or non-self cells. So they're the really aggressive part of our immune survival. So we could target them directly or target them through blood or pluripotential stem cells. The TCR, that T-cell receptor, is expressed only in T-cells and is activated to destroy malignant cancer cells expressing any abnormal antigen of the patient's tumour. We can select these cells for expansion or genetically engineer them to be extremely potent killers of our cancers. Now we have an internal surveillance system capable of removing any cancer stem cell that develops. This can last a lifetime if introduced through the stem cells in the body or be made patient-specific in large numbers by converting the patient's own T-cells to what we call iPS cells, induced pluripotential stem cells, the cells that we can take from anyone now and turn into something that's equivalent to an embryonic stem cell. So if you take a patient's T-cells, convert them to iPS cells, and then grow them back out to T-cells, they'll express the cancer-specific antigen, and you can use those for cancer therapy. If you make iPS cells, we can make billions and billions of those. So we have a very effective therapy for your cancer. So we'll expand them and redirect them into the activated T cells for tumour-killing purposes, and this would be an effective T cell therapy. The beauty of this system is it can be modified and tailored to work in concert with an active immune system, not against it. So usually in cancer therapy you'll recognise we give the patients heavy immune suppression because we want to use therapies to down the immune system. Well, this is not this system. We should also be able to reawaken the immune system for recognising and tolerating autoimmunity. The thymus can be regenerated now by cell therapy or with small molecules. So the thymus is the organ, it's the last discovered organ in the body, which is responsible for instructing the T-cells about self and non-self. It is a critical organ in the body, but once you go beyond puberty, it starts to regress. So it goes from an orange in the size of an orange in a 1 or 2 year old child to a tiny shriveled up peanut, or worse in a person of my age. So they've figured out how to reactivate that, and you can use small molecule, for example, targeting thymic epithelium transcription factor called Forkhead Box N1, or FROX N1, by Blackburn and colleagues in Edinburgh, and just published just recently. Wow. Very Melbourne. Foreign or allergenic cells and tissues will be tolerated, and potentially universal donor tissues will be available for immune compatible use by patients. This is requires we apply the power of tools discovered in immunology together with developments in stem cell biology and ensure we translate for the patient benefit. And Melbourne is the capital, the world capital for immunology, and it was and should be the capital for stem cells. At least Silvio is a beacon for stem cells in the Mesoblast company here in Melbourne. But what do we need? It's time that academics of science, funding agencies and government looked at such models as to refocus the limited public resources available in a much more strategic way. We need to really encourage the very smart academics to become interested in applying their discoveries for the community benefit. Universities have to change how they recognise and reward scientists who enter this pathway, not penalise them. It isn't about the number of publications or grants from the NH and MRC. These are not the measure for making the innovative contributions needed. They probably handicap the conversion to a more effective system that the community will recognise and endorse. The current federal grant system is broken in the USA. You can read about that, Albers and colleagues, in PNAS this year. And would not be any better here. Probably worse. Money is trickling down an unsustainable pipeline that fails to encourage developments for use by the community. The system must be fixed despite the inertia that exists even amongst the majority of scientists. We'll have no viable research environment soon if we continue to look away from the problems that are evident and are turning away our smart young scientists. We must quickly revise the direction we're taking. And one of those very smart young scientists is one of my sons, who said he didn't want to spend 6 to 8 months of every year applying for research grants that he didn't get. An incredibly smart guy, but he's not going to go into science. And many of the people that he worked with in the Walter Eliza Hall had the same view. These are young people who are being turned off. We need a viable and robust biotechnology industry with investors who are confident in the returns on investment. Australia is an attractive place for basic research, but it needs to become competitive in translation of these discoveries. Preclinical demonstration of safety and sound proof of concept for the candidate products with the accompanying regulatory requirements for pharmacokinetic data, processing, manufacture of the therapeutic candidate, development and validation of potency assays, etc., are areas of biotech experience that should be available for the raft of opportunities that exist here for translation. Typically, patent lawyers drafting patents should have experience in prosecution of IP. I think we need to link with US biotechnology industry to move this capacity, into places in Australia where sufficient clinical and scientific power exists. Melbourne is one of those key places. The experience might be illuminating and probably rewarding. So get on with it and get global. The Australian Research Committee must be globally linked to the other big engines of progress. This isn't a feature of research in Australia. Indeed, it's rare for universities' researchers in the same city to collaborate. I worked at Monash, and I didn't ever, rarely, if ever, collaborate with anyone with Melbourne University. Indeed, we cannot be competitive by working in isolation. Niche discoveries aside, we're less represented in the major journals with time, less recognised and less respected. The Asian tiger research communities, China, Japan, Korea and Singapore, are moving strongly to challenge North American dominance. And Europe is awake to the merits of collaborating. They use vehicles such as EU funding and granting. I encouraged Australians to collaborate with California in stem cells. They've been extremely competitive. They were awarded more collaborative grants than any other country besides Germany. These high-quality scientists are currently starving for funding here in Australia. We need to reevaluate the merits of becoming global partners in medical research and sharing the benefits with our collaborators that will flow from this work. We need to communicate with the whole community, inform them of the extraordinary opportunities of wealth and health creation. Time is of essence here. The so-called Australian clever country will not be recognised as that in the next decade or two without major change. We must change the way we fund research. We must consider how to reward scientists properly. We must expand the opportunities for expressing their smart ideas. We need to power up industry linkages to and partnerships with academia and medicine. We need to globalise our collaborations. We need to make science and medicine an industry to compete with resource-based commodities for wealth and prosperity of the whole Australian community. Most of all, we need to begin a dialogue with the Australian community about the benefits of medical research for our healthy ageing. I'll give you an example of returns over 23 years of $1,400 for every $1 invested in the original research grants for sequencing the human genome. $1,400 for every dollar invested. I think that would make everybody pleased in the private sector. And there's likely large economic benefit from investing in medical research in stem cells, pathogenic vaccines, cancer drugs, etc. And this needs to resonate in the halls of government, not just be a whisper from scientists returning to Australia with the aid of VESCI, or in my case, after managing $3 billion of Californian bond funds to drive a revolution in regenerative medicine. It might take 20 years to reward so well as this kind of investment, as it did in the human genome, but we need the support and we need the changes in the way we arrange this support for Australians to be living really smart and really healthy in 2030. Thank you very much.
Some challenging thoughts from Alan Trounson. Energy and chemistry, next phase of our conversation here. And who better to start that conversation than the inaugural VESCI Innovation Fellow and President-elect of the Australian Academy of Science, Professor Andrew Holmes. Now, he returned to Australia as a VESCI Innovation Fellow after more than 30 years at Cambridge University, where he and his team invented and commercialised a low-cost computer display. And upon returning, he was appointed University Laureate Professor of Chemistry in a new 100 million Bio 21 Molecular Biology and Biotechnology Institute, and continued to apply these same ideas to create low-cost plastic solar panels. Professor Andrew Holmes.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. The topic that I'm going to talk about is energy, and you will see the relationship to chemistry as we move on. The world's hungry for energy. It's unlikely that the human race will give up its thirst for consumption of energy, which really started after the Industrial Revolution. And it's so important to match the kind of lifestyle to which we've become accustomed. It's predicted that by 2030, the world's demand for energy will have doubled from around 2010. What's the situation in Australia? Almost half of the energy we use is in the form of electricity. In 2011, 75% of our electricity was generated from burning coal. And of that, 23% was burning brown coal, which of course sustained the tremendous industrial growth in Victoria since Sir John Monash introduced the brown coal power stations here in Victoria. And it has led to enormous wealth for this state. But now, Australia is the world's largest emitter of greenhouse gases at 16 metric tons per person per year. And that's in significant part due to the fact that brown coal doesn't burn very well, so we emit quite a lot of CO2 at the same time. Much more, for example, than if we burned a natural gas. So if we accept that greenhouse gases are the likely source of the gradual increase of the temperature of the Earth's surface, and I know there are many who doubt that assertion, but the evidence, as far as we can judge, is strongly in support of that correlation, then we've got to look to some other way of generating the electricity which we'll all want by 2030. And there are many possibilities. I'm going to focus largely on the use of the sun, which is really the cheapest and most abundant source of energy in the planetary system. The Earth's surface receives, on average, between 4 and 6 kilowatt hours for each square centimeter every day. And you can, if you look at your electricity bill for residents, you'll see that starts to become a serious source of potential energy for electricity. Now, switching back to Vesky, before I talk about my own experience, that's what Vesky is about. Vesky is about recruiting people, historically mostly Australians, back to Victoria so that they can contribute to the science base of this state and more broadly to that of the nation. It's almost 10 years to the day since I was lucky enough to be awarded a Vesky Fellowship, and one of the things we have done is to have picked up on the message that Alan has just given us. We have formed a collaboration. Instead of letting all these individuals beaver away in looking at alternative sources of harnessing the sun for solar energy, we formed a network of individuals, particularly here in Victoria, but also widely connected across the country. And the one that I'm going to talk about is a network, the Victorian Organic Solar Cells Consortium, which involves a strong collaboration between the University of Melbourne, CSIRO, and I'm associated with both institutions, and Monash University. So that's a good story in Victoria. And we formed a partnership with industrial partners, particularly BlueScope Steel, who are really interested in having solar cells that are actually part of the roofing material, and Innovia. Innovia make the plastic and also do the printing of our plastic polymer banknote, invented at CSIRO and exported to many countries around the world, even now in Canada, the first Northern Hemisphere country to adopt it, and also soon to be in the UK £5 note. And also Bosch, who are, of course, a very big company in electrical engineering products and were in solar cells. They've just moved away from that more recently. Now, they were interested more in the silicon solar cells. Silicon solar cells, the ones which are in the marketplace, deliver energy conversion at an efficiency of between 10 and 15%. And the question we have to address is, are we doing something that will compete? Well, not yet, but we hope that we shall eventually. And that's inspired by the vision of the Victorian state government, who've provided a large amount of funding, and also the federal government through the Renewable Energy Authority. Now we can make postage stamp size cell in the lab that work as well as that 10% target that is the silicon efficiency at the moment, the bottom of the silicon range. But what we want to do is print these on plastic, just like the way we print the banknote. And so, again, you can see that association with the CSIRO experience of the polymer banknote, and the company that prints them is hugely valuable in expanding our technology and capability. And if we can pull this off, I think we will create a real manufacturing opportunity here in Victoria, and it will be the opportunity to re-harness and redeploy people who've come from other sectors which are no longer the leading manufacturing, traditional manufacturing organisations. Even if that doesn't work, we will have created a capacity of about, a capability here of about 100 people who can work in this new field of plastic electronics. That is, electronics on plastic to substitute the traditional inorganic semiconductors which dominate the market at the moment. So where's that field of plastic electronics going? Well, I've talked about the printed solar cells, but also flat screen TVs. If you look at the Las Vegas Consumer Electronics Show, you'll see the big manufacturers demonstrating 50-inch diagonal displays based on organic light-emitting display technology. And the most exciting one, linking back to the healthy aging, or at least healthy lifestyle, is this flexible electronics. You can now print transistors on plastic. You can create a helmet put on your head, so a cricketer or a footballer could put this on, particularly a cricketer who's already wearing a helmet, and that will sense perhaps 80 different points of brain function simultaneously and transmit it back to someone in the medical centre back on the ground. So when a sports person gets hit on the head with a potential brain trauma, You won't have to ask them what day it is or what their mother's name is, because you'll have an instant readout from this plastic electronic helmet. That's where the technology is going. That's why it's so important that we should be creating the capability here in Victoria. And that's where the science from VESCI, the funding from science, is leading, and why we should really rejoice in the inspiration of those who created this wonderful, forward-looking organisation.
That was President-elect of the Australian Academy of Science, Professor Andrew Holmes. You're with Big Ideas on RN. You can share your thoughts on how we can become a smarter Australia for 2030 by visiting us online, abc.net.au/RN. What is most crucial for our future? For our next speaker, it's sustainable foods. And if you'd like to hear more about food production for the future, last week on Big Ideas we had a whole hour going into the details, and you can find a download of this discussion on our webpage. But now, to Professor Snow Barlow's insights. He's the director of the Australian Rural Leadership Foundation and VESCI chairman.
Food, we know the world is hungry for. But the global food equation is undergoing a once-in-a-century rebalancing as we speak. In 2050, there'll be somewhere between 9 and 10 billion people on this globe, requiring perhaps 70% more food than we currently produce. But that's not all, as Steve Jobs might say. There's one thing more. In the next 15 to 20 years, there'll be 2 billion more middle-class customers for food in Asia just above us. These customers will be all urban, and they will seek to buy their food in supermarkets, and they'll be seeking to buy more animal protein than they've been used to buying because they've got more money in their pocket. They'll be seeking to buy fresh fruit and vegetables, which they haven't had access to before, and they'll seeking to buy beverages, hopefully Australian wine. This rebalancing creates opportunities for Australia. On the other side of the supply side is the globe has dwindling supplies of available land and water. The land we do have is under pressure. It's under pressure from urbanisation, but it's always under pressure from nations that choose to subsidise biofuel production, in other words, the creation of energy from land that might have otherwise been used to grow food. And finally, as Andrew's already mentioned, we face a world with changing climates. And President Obama released quite a shattering assessment of the impact of climate change in the US, which had a lot to do with food production. So it's happening at present, and we know this because it's evidenced in the price of global food supplies. In the last 5 years, the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO's World Food Price Index, has twice peaked at 100% more of what the former decadal average was. In other words, it was about 100 units, and it went to over 200 units. It remains up at about 80% now. So, how should a smart country like Australia play in this new environment? That's the question in sustainable food. We are not the food bowl of Asia. Australia exports 70% of the food we grow, enough to feed an extra 40 to 50 million people. The world population increases by more than 50 million people every year. Clearly, that's not going to add up. In southern Australia, we're basically occupying all the agricultural land and using all the available water that is available. So expansion into new lands, new rivers, new dams is not an option here either. So what are our advantages? How should the sector respond? And in doing this, as I move through this There are amazing similarities, albeit in a very different field, in many of the things that Alan and Andrew were saying. Firstly, if you look at the Australian agricultural sector, it's well served with research and development. We punch about twice our weight in terms of research in publications internationally in agriculture, plant, animal sciences. We have an innovative, tech-savvy farm sector. They are pretty quick to take upon new innovations. But if we look at how it operates, we don't produce any of the hardware that that agricultural sector uses. We don't produce the tractors, we don't produce the harvesters, despite having actually invented a couple of harvesters, a coffee harvester and a grape harvester. We don't produce them. We don't produce the milking machines that drives Victorian's dairy industry. We don't produce the bottling lines that bottle our wine. We basically export, not exclusively, but largely soft commodities to the world at a competitive price. The food industry probably doesn't like to think about it this way, but we're really not a whole lot different from the mining industry. We're very good at producing efficiently and shipping out in big ships. Where's our future? Our future is clearly not in a race for being price competitive. It has to move towards looking how we can increase the value of the things we produce in this Asian, and that's why we talk about this Asian explosion of supermarkets as the Asian dining boom. How do we get our products onto those Asian tables? In the commodities we currently produce, mostly they arrive in supermarkets not branded as Australian because they're manufactured elsewhere. So clearly what we need to do is we need to find ways to work on our natural advantages in Australia. And we do have some natural advantages. We have an agricultural industry that could probably increase its productivity over the next 20 years by something like 50%. But we need to move up that value chain and use all the smarts we have, drawing on across the sectors more than we do at present. We can talk to some of Alan's medical mates, and you know, we need to produce projects on the supermarket shelf that have contingent health benefits. Whether that happens to be a gluten intolerance, whether that happens to be a vitamin A enrichment, whether that happens to be a omega-3 fatty acid enrichment in a particular product. And that product needs to arrive there with a label that says Brand Australia, which guarantees a safe product, which guarantees a provenance that it has been produced in a well-regulated production system that has traceability involved in it and has authentication in its claim, whatever that might be. If it's a health benefit, it needs to be authenticated. It's not a spin, it's a reality. So what do we need to do? What do we need to do to make those changes? As I said, they're not remarkably similar. They're not remarkably different from the things Alan and Andrew have talked about. The first thing we need is we need a strategic bipartisan plan that doesn't wobble. As Brian Smith said in March, we can't wobble from electoral cycle to electoral cycle in terms of a strategic plan for how we're going to apply our science through to innovation in a smart country. We need a commitment. It may look a little bit different under different governments, but it's got to be constant because smart people won't hang around if the money dries out. They are the people who are in most demand in the world. So, and that's indeed one of Vesky's big businesses. Second thing we need, again, the similarity, we need a collaborative approach between our industries, our food industries, our agricultural industries, and government, and the research institutions. We face a situation in Australia, as Alan said, that we evaluate our researchers according to how many publications they publish in international journals and how many times those publications are quoted. We don't evaluate our researchers in terms of the impact they might have had in the development of new products and services in whether it be Australia or elsewhere. So there needs to be a more comprehensive reward system for our scientists that values people who work in translational science, putting science into action, as well as people who beaver around in the lab and make basic discoveries. There needs to be an equal value of those contributions. And finally, we need to go international as well. Australia has traditionally been involved in international agricultural research, but in a developmental context. We still have an agency that works strongly in the developmental context, and that should remain. But we need to form research partnerships that actually can help us understand the markets we operate in and the products we want to develop. We need to develop research partnerships with Asia, with China, with India, with Japan, with Singapore. These are our major markets, and these are the people who, Alan has said, and I agree, are major contributors doing great science. It is not a developmental approach, it's a partnership approach that we need to do. So, finally, a smart country needs to develop a culture that can pervade the way we operate in our community. And Melbourne and Victoria is a great place to start this. It has a very fine tradition of research. It has a very fine tradition of networking across the community. That's what we need to do if indeed we're going to be a smart country in 20 years' time.
Thank you again to our professors, to Snow, to Andrew and to Alan. If you could come forward, gentlemen, and joined too by Alastair Lucas. Now, Alastair is chairman of investment banking at Goldman Sachs. He's going to share some of his views here as well. 23 years in banking, but he's more than a banker. He's also chairman of the Burnett Institute, where he's been a board member for 15 years, part of the group that formed Cell Care Australia, now Australia's largest cord blood bank. If I can bring you in right at the start, Alastair, to get you involved in this, the point that Alan makes about this valley of death between the funded research, the application, the idea taking its place in the world, how do we breach that valley of death?
Well, it's a very difficult problem. It has always been with us. I suspect it will always, to some extent, be with us. And, you know, the fault lies very, very clearly with a particular group of people, and that group of people is you in this room and the people here on the panel, because when we go to our financial advisors, we say, you know, we want our superannuation to be looked after, and we ask our financial advisor which fund is going to give the best return. And we want the best return out of our money, and the financial advisor will respond with the fund manager, which is focused on giving the best short-term returns. So, in a sense, you know, we're getting what we ask for. There has to be, I think it was Snow who talked about bipartisan. There really has to be a bipartisan discussion that will take government policy, for example, tax incentives to change the behaviour of investors such that the valley of death can be met through the use of economic incentives. We need to have a debate about this at a government level. It doesn't currently happen.
And this, Alan, is a point you make too, that You talked about the genome and the return on the investment on the genome, which was extraordinary. But the development time towards that return was long, which I think is the point Alistair's making too, that the appetite in the investment community is for a shorter term return. That's another part of that valley of death.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's solvable. I mean, Silvio solved it. There are solutions there. You really have to have people who believe in what you're doing. And so you really have to convince this Australian community you've got something very valuable, and they will invest in you. And if you go to an IPO, the people who understand that, who are willing to see maybe they might make wealth out of investing for a period of time again in that company, will enable that company to keep developing. So it's a matter of, I think, really educating the community. And that's the real problem with government. They're uneducated because we really haven't done it well enough. But I think there's examples, shining examples out there that show that you can do it. And I think you can do it frequently and effectively. And I think you can use the base which we have already. There, for example, are very strong superannuation funds in this country. And they're required to invest a certain amount of money in these kind of things, which would include the valley of death. But they need to be convinced. I mean, I had to convince Alistair to come along and invest in a couple of things I went into. It didn't all work out, and it didn't work out every time, but it has worked out sometimes. And eventually, you know, these things will roll forward.
These are your questions. This one is from Tony Paling. How exactly do you define smart? What will a smart Australia in 2030 look like? What precisely are we striving to achieve? How will we know when we achieve it? How do we plan to get there? Snow, have you got a thought on that?
Yeah, I had a nightmare last night that someone might ask me that question.
I was in your dream.
But I think we don't have too many other alternatives. In a sense, we'll know if we were smart in 2030 if our standard of living is the same as it is now relatively globally, if it is actually regressed in 2030 to where we stand now. We probably haven't been so smart, because we're a highly educated country. We have considerable resources. And what I suppose, in a trite way, I define as smart is being smart how you utilise those resources to develop wealth and social equity in the society you want to live in.
That's a really interesting point. That picks up a question that Helen Gardner has asked. And perhaps, Andrew, if I can get you to comment on that. This is about those sorts of benchmarks, the sort of goals that we set for ourselves. What benchmarks can we set in place now, Helen asks, to aim for and measure against? This will tell us when we're there.
In my experience, my benchmarks were formed actually by doing something outside Australia. And I can think of each stage being incrementally more demanding as a benchmark. And that was, first of all, going abroad to do a PhD and suddenly feeling very much a minnow amongst some very big fish, and developing the self-confidence and acquiring skills that I didn't have to work as well as those. And then working in a very stimulating university for most of my working life, where it took me 20 years to realize that it was brutal, but they were all very nice about it. But nevertheless, you had to benchmark yourself. And then lastly, having sabbatical leaves in the United States, and particularly in one of these areas where the ideas are fermenting and translating into product. Not that I, at that stage, had any idea about that, but if one is tuned to see and observe and self-mark, I think that's a very good way of estimating the kinds of qualities and benchmarking ourselves. So probably the ultimate thing is the thing that I think every speaker has mentioned, the need to have a strong international collaboration and also external peer review. That really gives us an idea of how we're doing compared with the rest of the world.
Well, it's delightful how these questions are leading into each other. This next one from Brett Wright. that sense of internationalism. And Brett says, does it make any sense to talk about a smart Australia when science and technology innovation are increasingly global activities that ignore national borders? Alan, you're working overseas.
I agree with that comment. And, you know, I don't think there's any good reason to have those borders. But what happens, I mean, I was in California. I couldn't actually fund work outside California. So what I did was to say, okay, well, I'll go to Australia and I'll get the Victorian government, in one hand, to co-fund the work that we were doing. So the Victorians could be involved in research with us in California, and then the NH and MRC to broaden it out to the whole of Australia. And that worked very effectively. So I went to 20 different countries and I got that to work. You know, but I couldn't get the money to go across the border because, you know, these were taxation monies or bond monies from that state or that country. But, you know, you can get the funding agencies to work together. And it's very effective because you have projects where the sun never goes down. You know, there's always going. So they're the projects that go really quickly, right? And they're the ones that are very effective. And I think if you ask Silvio, he doesn't work in Victoria. He doesn't do all his work here. He works globally.
Alistair, is that a secret in the funding of work, to have that international approach, to have a very broad and sort of universal sense of what you're doing?
There is, and this is very true of medical research, there's absolutely no point in doing research unless your research is world class, because simply it won't be world competitive. But I mean, I think the answer to this question is a simple, fundamental one. If, of course, technology is international, but does Australia want to be an importer or an exporter? If we want to be a wealthy country, we've got to be an exporter. And it's as simple as that. The technology will, if we didn't have Mesoblast, maybe Mesoblast is completely unique, but if we didn't have Mesoblast in Australia, quite likely there will be a Mesoblast created in America, and we'll be buying from America. It's much better than Mesoblast here in Australia.
And Snow, in your speech, when you're talking about our agricultural production, I mean, you make that precise point that we're viewing agriculture in the same way we view a quarry, that we're perhaps not developing our particular skills.
Yes, I think we've got to grow in this, and and back to the other question, what's what being smart is about. I think we've got to breach that divide, you know, from science into innovation to develop unique smart products. And, it is disappointing that Australia developed the first wine grape harvester, which are used internationally, but we don't manufacture. You know, we've tried to manufacture cars repeatedly and continually.
There's something in the national psyche there, isn't there? That's not quite...
Rather than perhaps making a similar investment and trying to corner the market on grape harvesters, which are quite large internationally. So just as an example.
Andrew, I'm going to give you the curly one so far. This is from Associate Professor Stella Clark, and she asks, how can we ensure that we have the political leadership, regardless of political persuasion, to ensure that smart Australia of 2030?
Well, of course, the power is with us as the voters, so it's in our hands, just as Alistair said earlier, with investment. Mind you, I'd like to see some investment, and we can talk about that later. But I think many politicians these days receive their training as political advisors to politicians. And this may not be the best training ground. It's obviously significant, but it may not be sufficiently broad. And yet we see time and again that many of the important decisions are being made and influenced by business and industry. So I think we've got to find a way of involving business and industry even more significantly in the political process. Maybe the US model of appointing special people to take charge of certain portfolios when a certain government comes into power is a way to do it. But ultimately it's in our hands, and they're the differences that I see that we need to think about.
Here's one from Dr. Anna Lavelle. All of you mentioned this territory of sort of collaboration, of pooling resources. Anna asks, what does smart look like in terms of a diversified economy? Export revenue, public health, access to life-enhancing technologies. What needs to change, Alan?
We need to change a lot of things. And currently, the research funding is broken. If it is the same as the US, and I believe it is, It's broken because we know we're producing the scientists, but they've got nowhere to go. So we have a limited number of universities, CSIRO, and research institutes. And what are we doing here? That's got to get fixed.
There seems to be a political awareness of that problem.
Yeah, but it's not being fixed. And I don't think the scientists want to fix it, because if you're actually getting funded by the system, you don't want to change it, right? So, you know, there's a malaise there, and it's a lethal malaise, and it's going to be poisonous. We need to develop a biotechnology industry, right? So we need to be able to convince the people to invest in it, because the biotechnology industry is a people industry. It comes from people who are willing to take a risk on new ideas, and we've got to do that. Ever since I've been involved in biotechnology, always recognised there's not enough of it. And in my area, there's very little, and it's not growing. And so we need to be able to make people more aware of the benefits of investing. And true, it does take longer. You're not going to get your money back inside, you know, 3 years. But if you're investing in a public company, you can sell your shares. You know, you can choose to sell it on the up or down and so on. So we have to be more creative right across the space.
And perhaps, Alistair, this is the thing, is getting the funding out of public hands into more private hands and exploring new methods. Dr. Scott Watkins, a question here. With the rise of crowdfunding and rapid prototyping, how can big investors and investment funds connect with the lone entrepreneurs, the lean startups?
Well, I mean, I think it's happening, happily. Crowdfunding is clearly new. I'm not sure how much is raised through crowdfunding at the moment, but it's probably five to 10 billion around the world. It's growing enormously quickly, and it gives great hope that those kinds of connections between inventors and funding can just be made a whole lot more efficient. But look, at the moment it's tiny. The US stock market is perhaps 15 trillion. I don't know how much that would be raised on the US capital markets in equity every year, but several trillion, right? So 5 to 10 billion is just a drop in the ocean, but it's come from a few hundred million to 5 billion. So I think we should have some significant optimism that crowdfunding can really help.
Optimism is a nice note on which to stop this segment of our conversation this evening. Thank you all so much for coming.
From the Vesky Symposium tonight, you heard Professor Snow Barlow, Director of the Australian Rural Leadership Foundation and Vesky Chairman, President-elect of the Australian Academy of Science, Professor Andrew Holmes, Professor Alan Trounson, President of the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, and also Alistair Lucas, Chairman of Investment Banking at Goldman Sachs. RN's Jonathan Green moderated the discussion.
Why is motherhood such a rich subject for horror movies? Think Rosemary's Baby, The Omen, and now think The Babadook. That's the film we'll be discussing this week, an Australian horror that got rave reviews out of Sundance that's now coming home. The director, Jennifer Kent, will be discussing it ahead of its release next week. And I also ask, why aren't other Australian movies this good? That's The Final Cut with me, Jason DeRosso, online anytime at the RN website.